This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name is Safa Şenemiş. I'm an Australian broadcaster of Turkish heritage. And I hope you're ready for tonight. I hope you've got someone here you can hold hands with or at least hide behind, because things are about to get rather spooky. We are going to try our best to scare the bejesus out of you. And to take us into those dark corners, let's meet our panellists. Today they are Sami Shah, a comedian and writer, and he's written this fantastic book full of chock-full of scary beings. It's called Fireboy. And Nadia Diaz, a writer and academic at the University of Melbourne, and she's got a special interest in fantasy creatures. Hi to you both.
Hello.
Now, Sami, congratulations on your book. As I said, it did scare me witless.
It worked. Excellent. As intended. Right.
Now, towards the end of the book, this is what you write. I've been attacked by djinns, kissed by a Chudail, and I'm probably butchering that now.
Right.
Chudail, there you go. And abused by a boy who claims to be the king of Karachi. Now, these are the monsters that you grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to everyone, what's a djinn?
So it's a slightly loaded question, because there's the assumption of what a djinn is and what a djinn actually is. Djinns, as you might know them, are genies, which is, from Aladdin's lamp, and it comes out and it's played by Robin Williams.
I dream of genie.
That's right, I dream of genie is that entertaining creature who grants three wishes and is funny and those kind of things. But that's not the djinn that we grew up with in Pakistan, for example. In Pakistan, and in most Muslim countries, the jinn comes from the Quran. When Allah made the world and he made all the creatures in the world, he made humans who are made of earth and clay and sand and dirt. And he made jinns who are made of smokeless fire. And that's in the Quran. And if you believe the Quran, then you have to believe in jinns. And they are creatures with abilities like shape-shifting and the ability to possess people and things like that, who exist around us, but we can't see them, they can see us. And those are what we used to frighten us as children. They were our bogeymen, our poltergeist, things like that.
I mean, you said they were shapeshifters. Were they particularly scary looking? I mean, or did they come in the form of a cuddly teddy bear?
Well, they could if they want to. I don't know. We didn't hear many cuddly teddy bear stories.
No. Ugly, huge, huge, big black dogs. And stuff.
Yeah, it was usually black cats, black dogs, because their natural shape is completely black. In terms of they're like walking silhouettes with eyes filled with fire. And so they could change shape, and normally they become a cat, or they could become someone. We used to have a lady who lived down the street from our house in a thatched hut, who was just a lady who'd built a thatched hut and lived in that street. But as kids, we were like, she's clearly a djinn.
She sounds like a witch.
Yeah, she must be. So, yeah.
And Nadia, what were some of the stories that you were told when you were growing up that haunted you?
Oh, gosh. Well, with the djinn in particular, there's that big black silhouette with the eyes of fire. That was just, I mean, what more do you need to scare a child? And it was just that. I used to dream that they'd like come in through the window and stuff like that. I was very easily scared. Still am. And we used to watch a show called Alif Lela. You probably watched that too when you were a kid. Which is 1001 Nights, and they featured djinns and stuff like that. So there was constantly.
But even in that, the djinns, because they were for television.
Yeah, they were a little more.
They were a little more
tempered.
Yeah, but they weren't the djinns that for example are religious studies teachers or our parents and everyone would tell us about. Yeah.
You mentioned that, you know, that they are very much linked to Muslim mythology. When I was growing up, in some of the Turkish relatives would say to us, if someone had epilepsy, for instance, or if they had nightmares, or if they had sleeping ailments, or if they kind of were a little bit aggressive, that person was clearly possessed by a djinn. Is that the type of story that you were told in Pakistan?
We had, if someone was misbehaving, so my brother would misbehave, which he was prone to do quite often, the family would say, oh, it's pe djinn chadh gaya, which means a djinn has now possessed him clearly. So that was the obvious one and the easy one, but they were more frightening. There would often be cases. I went to a mazar once, which is a place where a Sufi saint is buried in Karachi, and over there, in the back, there were rooms where women were tied up, and those women were tied up because they kept thrashing out and attacking, and the belief was that those women were possessed by jinns, because they were speaking in different voices and they were reacting in strange ways. The eyes weren't visible; it was just the whites of the eyes.
Sounds like a scene out of The Exorcist.
Well, that's just it. It's because the only difference was that they were actually, and many times it would turn out to be so, they were women who were told that they were about to be married off to someone that they didn't want to marry, and so they would say, "The jinn has possessed me," and then fake a jinn possession to get out of the marriage, which is something that in some parts of Pakistan you have to do to get out of a marriage, I guess.
And in a lot of the Muslim countries, arranged marriages are particularly common. So I'm assuming faking jinn possessions, Nadia, would be the way to go.
I've heard of that, definitely. Yeah, it's something that's fairly easy to do because people talk about it all the time. You get a list of all the symptoms and stuff handed to you, and it's like, well, why not use it? It's a
great way because it's one of the things nobody wants you after that.
Yeah.
You're like damaged goods.
Well, yeah, basically, yeah. Because it's one of those things that's like, oh, my son has a green card and my son's an engineer. Oh, my daughter was possessed by a jinn. and word always gets around and there is that element. Which is an easy way of saying, and obviously because right now in the rational area that we're in, it's easy to say that that's why they were doing it. But there are people back there who believe genuinely, no, she was possessed by a jinn because she walked under a tree at sunset with her hair open. And that is when jinns possess women and those kind of things that are stuff that we were told.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of women themselves believed it, because the idea that you would say no in the first place is so strange and weird, then you must be possessed by a demonic force, etc.
So it became a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the other things that I was told when I was growing up was that, you know, when you brushed your hair, you better clean that hairbrush afterwards because the jinns particularly like hair. What else do they like, Sammy?
Sweet things, desserts. We were told never pick up... no, it's true. We were told never pick up candy off the floor because if that's a ploy that jinns use to possess you. So if a child finds candy, like toffee in a wrapper on the ground, and opens it and eats it, that's the vehicle the jinn uses to possess you. Jinns frequently enjoy hiding things. I live in a very old house in Karachi. The house I grew up in was 60, 70 years old. And again, I don't rationally believe any of this. I'm a grown man who's basically not prone to believing any of this, except at night you do believe these things.
Yes.
And at night, I believe the fact that things used to go missing in our house, and you'd look and you'd look and you'd look, and then sometimes you get really frustrated, and you'd go, okay, just give it back, please, and then it would be there. And it's ridiculous, but, you know, it happened.
Did you ever try to converse with a jinn? I mean, I know that, you know, in Australia, we'd often play with the Ouija board. We'd want to meet a spirit. It was fun. That's what kids did, right? Did you ever try and summon a jinn?
So two, three things happened in the house I lived in, which was the first one was, and again, I know how these sound, but they are what happened. The first one is we used to have suitcases on the roof, right? And we'd keep them over there, and because that's where you store all the suitcases. We had a storage area up there. And one day my friends were over, and we're playing, and it's just us in the house, like six boys, 60, like all of us, like 10, 11 years old. And one of the suitcases started toppling down the stairs. And we heard these thumping sounds, and we went outside, and we saw a suitcase was lying in the middle of the stairs where there's a landing. So there's like a 5-foot landing, and then the stairs continue, and the suitcase is lying flat there. And we're like, oh, that's weird, it must have fallen down. And we turned, and we heard the thumping again. We turned around, the suitcase was falling down again. So we're like, that's very odd. And the second time, we were all playing outside. We're playing cricket, and it's nighttime, and we're playing in the garden. And one of my friends said, dude, who's that? And I remember, again, I was like 13 years old, and we looked up, and there's a man looking at us from the roof, from the ceiling, the roof of the house, sorry. And he's up there, and he's a man looking down.
A thief?
We don't know. We all went running up. We're like, oh, whatever, thinking it's a thief and hoping it's a thief. Nothing. There was no one there. And then the third time, we finally did that, where one of my friends was like, what if it's a djinn in your house? What if it's a djinn? Like, I was like, all right, fine. So we're all sitting around, and we're like, and so one of my friends was an idiot. He very loudly said, if you're a djinn, prove it. And all the lights dimmed. For 1 second, all the lights dimmed.
And what was this, and collective urination at that
there
time?
There was definitely a stink. and a lot of boys went running out of the room. And we all right now, if you did talk to any of us who went through that, we'd be like, it's just a coincidence or whatever. But again, it happened.
Nadia, do you think this was a boy thing? Did the girls react to djinns in the same way?
Oh yeah. We used to make our own Ouija boards. We couldn't buy them. So we had to, we'd get these sort of bits of paper and make them ourselves, and then do the whole like any passing spirits and stuff. And we used to get told off because you're not supposed to do that, because what
it's
if you don't get a ghost? Yeah, it's not a joke, and you might not get a ghost. You might get an actual djinn. Because there's a difference between ghosts and djinn, obviously. Ghosts are, spirits.
Let's clarify that. Yeah. What are the differences?
Well, a djinn, like Sami said, are beings that sort of occupy a different plane from ours. They can see us, but we can't see them, which is, again, like fundamentally creepy.
Unfair as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is,
some people can see them.
Some people can see them. Babies apparently can see them. So when little children are sort of laughing to themselves in cots, it's because there's a djinn
interacting with the djinn.
Yeah.
Who needs a babysitter when you've got a djinn?
Oh, absolutely. You can just leave it because there are djinns around.
That's a plot of Labyrinth, by the way.
Oh, my God. Yes, that's true.
Sorry.
Cultural appropriation. But anyway. So we used to call them and I mean, again, like through my in-laws in particular, there's all these stories of like you walk into a room and all the furniture is sort of standing on end. And unfazed, the grandmother or whoever it was at the time would say, we'll just put it back when you're done, close the door, walk out, come back, and everything's back the way it was. So there's this sort of poltergeisty element as well, except that, and the other thing I was going to say is that the djinns can probably see us because they came first. So in Islamic sort of mythology, the devil, the shaitan, is actually a djinn.
He's not a fallen angel. Yeah. In Christianity, he's a fallen angel.
Yeah.
In Islam, he's a djinn.
Yeah, because first the beings of fire were made, and then the beings of earth were made. And when God said to bow down to them, some of the djinns went, "We're made of fire. We're not bowing down to lumps of earth." And so they were cast out, and so on. So and the word shaitan, which is Satan, I think. Azazel Iblis
means to despair, which is one of his names. Azazel is another name, and Shaitan is Satan.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the thing is, Shaitan is also that whole. It means Satan, of course, but it also is used fairly innocuously. Like when a child misbehaves, you call them Shaitan. It means naughty. So that it sort of goes back to the whole being possessed by jinns, making you behave badly.
Looking at Shaitan, if we sort of look at the West, in the West, there's devil worshippers.
Right.
There's Shaitan worshippers. Do you have that in Pakistan as well, in djinn mythology? Do you have djinn worshippers?
Well, we have people. So there's a religious uncle in the family. Every family has one uncle who's particularly pious.
Oh, yes.
And he claimed he could see djinns. He used to come over and he'd pray. So the story was that he would wake up every morning for the Fajr prayers, which is the early dawn prayers. He wouldn't wake up. Someone would wake him up. And it was always a thing. He's like, because he prayed for that, I never want to miss my Fajr prayers. So please send a djinn to help me. And so a djinn would wake him up every morning. That's what he said.
He collaborated with djinns.
Apparently. Like, he used them for snooze alarms. I don't know. But that was something he believed. And as children, you believe that. And then he'd do things. Like, so he'd come over and he'd be like, I remember asking him once, is there a djinn in our house? Because at that point, I was convinced there was. And he said, yes, of course there is. And I was like, is it in the room right now? And he's like, no, not at all. It's over there in that room. And that room was one of the guest bedrooms. And I was like, all right, I'm never going in there now. Like, that room is dead to me. But people claim to interact with djinns. So there is the belief that if you are particularly religious, particularly pious, you can get jinns to do favors for you. And jinns, because jinns can travel fast and they can fly and they can see things that other people can't see and find things that have been lost. So that's if you are a person who's pious and wants to collaborate with jinn. If you're someone who's got nefarious purposes in mind, then you can sit in a room by yourself, and there's Surah Jinnat, which is in the Quran, which is a chapter in the Quran about jinns, and you can read that entire thing and keep chanting it again and again and fast. And if you do that for 7 days, the jinn will appear, show you horrific things, which if they don't drive you insane at the end of it, you then control the jinn. And so we used to believe that there were people out there who would do black magic on the family with those methods.
With the risk of insanity.
That's right.
Yeah.
But jinns can also be useful, according to your book, can't they, Sammy? I mean, there's a case where you write about in the book where a university professor, of all people, is trying to harness
the
power of jinns because he's trying to sort out Karachi's
energy
problem. That's surely fictional.
No, I wish it was. In Karachi, in Pakistan, basically during the 70s, we had a dictator called Ziaul Haq, who was extremely fanatical and quite lunatic-like, much like most dictators. And he decided that there should be a nuclear program. And obviously he wanted people to, you know, the scientists wanted funding and everything like that. So a lot of scientists said, you know what, we for nuclear fusion, we should just use jinns. Like, why do we have to go and steal technology from other countries? And there are still scientists who said this in the press. There's one scientist who's famous in Karachi University who got kicked out by the rest of the academia because his big achievement was calculating the rate at which heaven is receding away from us. So there is that kind of religious mix with science and math in some of these areas because they know that that's how you get funding from the government or maybe they are just that crazy, but they do believe some of those things.
And how are these scientists treated, Nadia?
With great embarrassment. some people believe that, but I think mostly there's the stories you tell your children to scare them, and the stuff that scares you at night, especially when you're by yourself and stuff, when the power goes out, particularly. And then there's this kind of stuff where it's mostly just embarrassing. But then again, if the army is willing to fund you, then they're willing to fund you. So, I don't know. I mean, and then that makes me wonder how sincere they actually are, because if it's just a quick way to make a buck, then, you know.
And you've been researching jinns lately. Is there anything new that you've discovered that you didn't know along the way?
That there are many, many different classes of jinns, and that there's a hierarchy. And also that they're actually fairly ordinary. I mean, the interaction between humans and jinns is scary and all of that. But fundamentally, they're just beings going about their lives. There are religious jinns, there are non-religious jinns, there are Christian ones and Muslim ones and various. You know, basically everything that we do, jinns do as well. So it's only when the crossover happens that trouble can arise. And there are some mischievous ones that want to create trouble. That will, you know, leave candy out for children.
One of my favorite types is the jinn in Iran. This is a part of Iranian folklore, which is that if you're a Bedouin or if you're traveling at night and if you sleep in a tent, sometimes a jinn will appear, and there's a certain class of jinn with very long tongues. And they'll appear and they'll sit outside your tent at night, and the tongue will enter your tent and it'll lick the undersoles of your feet. And that's how they just abrade the undersoles until it starts bleeding, and that's how they drink your blood. And that's
I feel
something to
Ill
think about.
Now.
I'm just saying. Next time you go camping, wear your shoes.
No more sleeping barefoot ever again.
And Nadia, you've spent time in various parts of the world. Yeah. We've got these little mascots here. I'm not sure if people can see them, but they're kind of menacing looking. Can you tell me a little bit about them and whether the jinn story sort of translates from different culture to different culture? First of all, let's talk about these little mascots.
Well, these two I've learned only recently, are actually called the Yakamanu. And I've had them since I was born. I was born in Sri Lanka and my parents bought them, and they were told that they were good luck devils. And they've travelled with me every single. I've moved what 10 times in my life, and they've come with me into every household, and they're just little good luck bringers, and they're a little bit like gargoyles in that they sort of serve to protect the house and
good
stuff.
Luck devil seems like an oxymoron, yeah, it doesn't, right?
It does quite a bit, but it's just I think the word devil is used quite differently in South Asia. Like, it doesn't mean devil as in Christian mythology, but it's more, I think, probably because the word dev and deo, they all mean sort of demon-like creature. So they're not the specific thing that a jinn is, but they're all sort of these mystical creatures that that kind of sound like devils, so we just go with devil.
Because there's a difference in Christianity, for example. Satan is the king of hell, right? And the famous line, better rule in hell than serve in heaven. But at the same time, in Islamic mythology, Shaitan, Iblis, was a jinn. He fell from heaven to earth, but he doesn't get to rule hell. Allah rules hell. Allah rules everything. And when the day of judgment happens, Shaitan will also go to hell like everyone else. So there is that difference in that he's less exalted, or not, I suppose exalted is the wrong word. He has less power and influence than the satanic, morning star, lightbringer, whatever his name was. Yeah.
So why do you think, in this current global climate, we've got so many real things to fear, and I'm thinking particularly terrorism at the moment. I mean, you touch upon Pakistani politics even in your book and sort of looking at sectarian divides, Sammy, and weave it into the jinn story. Why do you think these creatures particularly still spook us when we've got so many real things to be petrified about?
Because I think there's a few things. One is they're a metaphor. There's that aspect to it. They are allegories for things that do frighten us. The zombie movies that keep coming out, and I'm not the first person to say this, there have been many academic papers written on this, that the zombies are an allegory for middle-class uprisings and the 1% being frightened of the lower economic classes kind of coming and getting them and those kind of things. For us growing up, the jinns were basically... The things that can get you are serial killers, are kidnappers, are terrorists, are thieves. Those are things that you can't control, right? They can happen at any point. You go to the mall and a terrorist blows it up and you're dead. You can't do anything about that. But with the jinn, you can, right? So Allah has provided you with protection. There's certain portions of the Quran which if you recite at night, and there's a ritual. We used to do that as kids always. Every night, you'd say the three different ayats, which are the portions of the chapter, the little segments of the Quran, and you'd say them out loud, and you'd kind of blow around the room, and you'd clap three times, which my mom told me was to wake up the angel Jibreel and tell him that to protect you. I don't know why, but as a child, I was lying in bed doing that. And we'd do those things, but the idea was these malevolent creatures can't harm you. So there's something comforting in knowing that there's evil out there, but Allah will protect you from that, or you can protect yourself from that. Whereas terrorists and things like that, those you can't protect yourself. So I suppose maybe it's an element of teaching you to control that your fears can be controlled and can be managed, and don't let them dictate your life. Maybe.
Nadia, you mentioned that jinns can also be Christians and from other faiths. Why do they then belong to the Islamic tradition, do you think, when they themselves clearly have got a choice to be not Muslim?
Yeah, I think that's just because they exist in Islamic mythology and they come from the Quran. If you haven't read the Quran or haven't grown up around the ideas of... I mean, I haven't read the Quran. If you haven't grown up around the idea of the jinn, then they don't exist. They may be going to your church, but you don't know that because you don't know they exist.
The etymology of the jinn is also rooted in ancient Arabic culture. So it's more to do with that particular location where Islam kind of sprung from. It was very localized to that area. And so it spread to Arab countries more, I think.
In Western pop culture, some of the monsters, over the years have sort of become a bit light. I'm thinking, Simon Pegg's
Shaun of the Dead. Right, yeah. Or Sparkling Vampires.
And yeah, like all the right. what We Do in the Shadows, The Flight of the Conchords. Or, you know, if we go way back, you know, Michael J. Fox in Teen Wolf or Ghostbusters, new and old. Yeah. None of those are particularly frightening. The scariest thing I've watched, you know, is Doctor Who's Weeping Angels.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good one. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking, are any of the monsters in Islamic mythology going down that path as well in pop culture, or are they always menacing?
They're still treated with too much reverence, I think. Mm. And that's one of the differences. I think what, for example, in Western pop culture, we've commoditized them so much where it's gone from, you know, the werewolf or something has gone from something that's so frightening to Michael J. Fox that it can no longer be frightening. We've had to invent new ones. So you've got the angels from Doctor Who, or you've got Slender Man, which is a new thing, and you've got new monsters kind of being created because people have that need and desire. Whereas in places like Pakistan and all that, or most Muslim countries, the jinn is still treated with reverence because it's linked to the Quran. Those things cannot be ridiculed or should not be ridiculed. And if you believe in them, if you believe in the Quran, then you believe in jinns. No, I mean, very few rational people, very few, even Christians, don't believe in vampires and werewolves. They'll believe in demonic possession, maybe. Exorcist is still scary for that reason.
Because it has a religious link.
Because it has that connotation, which it could happen. Like, people die, maybe there's a devil, maybe ghosts, maybe Pazuzu is a thing. Like, that's a part of that. But the idea that werewolves might, you know, attack us right now, no one's going to be walking home frightened of a werewolf at night.
I don't know. I might have nails, you know.
Right, yes. Just a silver bullet gun. But, yeah. but you know, sometimes, like when I was writing the book as well, I was like, I would frighten myself, you know. I would write a chapter and then I'd go outside for a smoke back then, and I'd be standing there in the dark and I'm like, now there's going to be a djinn. Now there's going to be a djinn. Now there's going to be... And you just go back inside.
I did have a night's troubled sleep, thanks to you. So.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
And Nadia, I mean, sticking to pop culture, how do you think then the djinn that we're talking about ended up in Western pop culture in the form of when, you know, Sammy mentioned originally in, like, Aladdin, for instance, or you know, I Dream of Jeannie? How do you go from the interpretation that we're discussing now to that, where he just grants you wishes and, you know, is friendly?
Translation, mostly. Especially when we're talking about Alif Lela and the witches, which is the 1001 Nights, and the sort of domestication of the mythologies that the West of it has encountered elsewhere. Those stories exist, obviously, but... you know, they had an element of entertainment and stuff to them. And so the genie that grew out of the djinn became a sort of more friendly character. And obviously, I mean, it was Disneyfied even after that. But, I mean, you have Victor Hugo writing about the djinn as this sort of haunting presence. Like, they were apparently supposed to be heralded by the sound of chimes and bells and things like that. There's an entire poem in French where he sort of talks about the djinn. So it sort of went that way. It sort of went via, I think, French and then into English, and then it sort of and lost a lot of its cultural connotations along the way. Because as we were saying earlier, djinns can be enslaved in a way, and if they are, then they have to do your bidding. So that, I think, that then morphed into the friendly genie.
I feel like we can't continue on with this session without talking about the... I'm going to butcher the name again. The Chudael?
Chudael.
Chudael.
Right.
Tell us about that, Sammy.
Like, we've got other creatures. The djinns are the ones from Quranic mythology, and then we've got other things, which every culture kind of develops itself. Mm. And so one of the ones is, we were told always... Well, there's two things. In the book, I've kind of cheated a bit and merged two different things. The Chudael is a witch. It's a woman who practices black magic and can be approached, if you know a Chudael, to put spells on people. My grandmother was a big believer in Chudaels and things like that. And so they exist. And the other one, parallel to that, is the Pichalperi. And I'm going to combine the two in the book. But Pichalperis are, we were told that if you're driving home at night, on one night of the year, every year, on one particular night, a woman will be standing on the roadside in a wedding dress and hailing a car, because that's the night that she died on, when she was murdered on her wedding night by her husband, and she haunts the spot where she died, and she'll be hailing a car, and if you stop the car and let her in, if you don't notice when she's stepping into the car that her feet are twisted backwards entirely, then she will kill you and eat you. And that was the thing we were told, and that was the only way of knowing. And she was wearing a long flowing dress, so you can't see the feet. The only time you can see it is when she steps into the car. And the one sign being that the toes aren't in front, everything is twisted back, and that's how she walks. And
it's like a Roald Dahl story on steroids.
That's right. And we used to have that thing where I remember when I was a teenager, for example, I'd be driving home at night, and I'd turn the side view mirror the rear view mirror the other way, so I couldn't see in the back seat, because we were told sometimes she'll appear in the back seat, for example, and if you see the reflection, then you're dead. Like, those kind of things. Not a road safety thing at all, by the way, just not. But what was interesting, I heard that, and we used to call them pichalperi. Pichalperi means feet backwards.
Yeah.
And I met a friend of mine from Venezuela, and he said in Venezuela they've got the same kind of story about a woman in a wedding dress standing like that. And then I was living in WA for the last few years, and I had a friend of mine in Perth who swears, and this is a very rational guy, normal guy, who swears that one night he was on the Great Eastern Highway, which is a highway cutting through the middle of WA, at night, alone driving, and there's a woman in the middle of the road in a tattered white dress, and he stopped the car because she was right in the middle and he had no choice. And he says she had a back towards him, so he hit the horn, and she started turning around, and she was holding her head in place as she turned, and he just reversed and went the other way. And
I'd say that was heat exhaustion.
Possibly. But if you want to get into like the metaphorical, allegorical aspects of this, then yes, it's something to do with male fears of women, empowerment, and probably just pathetic fears of marriage and all those things. But if you want to just take it at face value, yeah, it's a really frightening image.
Yeah. And Nadia, that story has a particularly strong, almost feminist component to it, doesn't it?
Well, yes, because the Chorel that I know is the same thing as the Pichalperi.
Right.
And it's generally a woman in the Punjab, sort of across India and Pakistan. It's a woman who's died in childbirth or was mistreated during her pregnancy and died as a result. And in the Hindu tradition, at least, you are not supposed to cremate her. You're supposed to bury her after having like nailed her arms and legs down and done all kinds of things. Because otherwise she'll come back and wreak revenge on the men who mistreated her. And the Chorels only ever go after men. Because they're the ones who mistreated her.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's true. That there is very much a sort of a fear of vengeance. Or, you know, deserved
women's power,
vengeance.
Right, yeah,
or just, you know, if you mistreat us, we might come back and eat your family, which I think is fair. but the interesting thing is that there's an Indonesian creature called a Pontianak, which is effectively the same thing, whereas, again, it is a woman who dies in childbirth or as a result of mistreatment while she's pregnant and who comes back and does exactly the same thing. The backwards feet is particularly South Asian.
That's a South Asian.
That's our twist
Dutch.
On it.
Yeah.
You see, that hasn't translated into Turkish culture from the Islamic tradition. Maybe it has, but I haven't heard that story. So the jinns I'm familiar with, but not that particular story. I mean, speaking of those two separate monsters, do they, we can't see jinns, for instance. Can they see chorels?
Can jinns see chorels?
Yeah.
I don't even know about team-ups. I'm not even getting into that's a whole other book.
Can they plot against us together?
Yeah. If we can see chorels, and it stands to reason the jinns who can see us can see them.
Well, because the different, it's a menagerie of creatures, right? So it's a different thing. It's basically the chorels are the returned souls of women who've been wronged. The jinns are supernatural creatures. Then there's just the dead, which is called bhoot, which is basically someone who died and his ghost comes back. And then there's, you know, one or two other things. So the idea is that there are, every culture has their own myths and monsters, and each of them represent different aspects of belief within the culture.
And speaking of sort of different aspects of culture, Nadia, you, in part of your work, you look at translations of poems, and you say in one particular instance that in some poems they just sort of lost in translation, that they don't go from the original meaning, the original language, to whatever language they're being translated into. Can we apply that to monsters, for instance? Are some monsters just scary to some people and some communities? For instance, the djinn might maybe not scare a Dutch person.
Quite possibly, because I think a lot of it depends on context, and if you don't have the context around you, then it's less relevant. I think the thing about translation, the Victor Hugo poem is a great example of that, because of how he sort of transmutes the djinn into French. They become a different thing. They become this wondrous sort of almost alluring kind of creature, but not quite the terrifying thing that, you know, with the eyes of fire and all of that. So they lose a lot of that. And another creature that translates badly because it already exists in English is actually much more benign. It's from the Indus Valley civilization, the unicorn, because there is a seal. There's a seal, like a sort of rectangular object. Yes, let's just bring all the entire zoo into it. But it's this four-legged creature with a single horn coming out of its head, and this was made about 4,000 years ago, so we don't have a reference for it. But there's a poem by the Pakistani poet called Fez, written in English, about the unicorn and the dancing girl. The dancing girl is another iconic sort of statue that comes out of the Indus Valley civilization. And he talks about how difficult it is to explain what this creature is when there is already a unicorn out there. Like, how do you... It's referred to as the unicorn, but it's not that unicorn. It becomes really, really difficult to explain. So I think we've just sort of ignored it.
Sidelined it.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, it's too hard.
But there's an aspect, like you're saying, with the translation and the cultural context, where people who don't have that context, with jinns and Islam and all that, that who've read the book, will have told me, oh, it's really creepy. But people who have that context have told me, like you said, I had sleepless nights. And I think that's just the one step where it goes a little bit further for them, because for them, it harkens back to childhood stories.
Yeah.
Whereas for anyone else, it's just, oh, this is interesting.
Oh, yeah. Regularly we would be told, you'll be struck by a djinn. Once you hear that one or two times, and, you know, once you see an imam, we should talk about this, trying to lure out a djinn.
Right.
It's pretty frightening to see. Have you ever witnessed
that? I have once.
Yeah.
It's very similar to the power of Christ compels you scene from Exorcist, but with more beating involved. The imam he was reciting prayers from the Quran. There was a grown man tied to a table who was lashing out and screaming and making sounds. And I was working for a news channel at the time, and someone told us this was happening, so I went down to see if I could turn into a story. And the imam was beating him with a stick. And basically, he just beat him and beat him until he fainted. And then when that guy woke up, there was no djinn in him anymore. So I don't know whether it's the case of the djinn actually got beaten out of him, or the man was like, this is not worth the commitment. Like, this is really...
Have there been instances where it's gone bad? I mean, there has been stories where
many
exorcisms, people have actually died because they've beaten them to death.
These happen in rural areas a lot. Right, so that's part of the problem. Is that it's not exactly like you have like confirmed data on any of it, but in rural areas, every now and then in Pakistan, you hear stories of the woman possessed by jinn, and then the imam tried getting it out of her, and then she died. A child possessed by jinn, and the child died while the imam tried saving it. Like, those kind of stories come out, and yeah, it's not something that's ideal, and the superstition is clearly something that's causing people to lose their lives, but. How do you stop that? That's the problem. Is the only way to stop that is by informing and educating, and that's a larger issue.
And Nadia, how do you decide when someone is or isn't possessed by a djinn? I mean, someone might be ill, for instance. I mean, I mentioned epilepsy earlier in the conversation. Is it family members usually who decide that they've been possessed, or do they first of all take the so-called possessed person to a mosque and have them checked out?
I think it varies, but usually there's that religious uncle who is consulted, or the grandmother, or the, you know, elderly aunt who knows everything, and they tend to determine whether or not there is possession. And then that then gets escalated to, that sounds very official, right? Or escalated to the imam, and then bad things happen. But yeah, I mean, often it is something like epilepsy or another disorder or something that's sort of causing the whatever symptoms are being are showing up, and that can go very, very wrong.
And so, I mean, going back to pop culture, you and I were told earlier this week that the Chidal is mentioned in a Tom Waits song.
That's right. I had no idea about that. Yeah.
Is there many instances where they pop up in various guises in Western pop culture particularly?
Look, not the Chidal as such. That's the only one I've heard of. Like I said, there's variations of the same myth that are across cultures. And so there are, you know, like, for example, even the jinns have their own version in Native American culture, which is the skinwalker, which is someone who can change shape, and a witch doctor, and those kind of things. The thing is that everyone has these kind of stories that they spread and they tell them, and that's how they communicate their fears to different generations, which is how stories like the Chidal and everything perpetuate. Whether that crosses over into Western society, I don't know. I haven't seen much of it yet. It's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is I just wanted people to know about our monsters for once. And I hope it does. And it'd be interesting to see how it mutates then, because there is that that tradition almost in Western societies to take other cultures and remix them a bit and make them something new. And it'd be kind of fascinating to see where it goes.
And do you take great delight in telling people scary stories, particularly when they don't know about this tradition?
I love that.
What's your favourite?
My favourite one is just that the Chidal story. Mm-hmm. Because there's just something about when you reveal the thing of the feet turned backwards, it's such a cerebral moment where people have a physical reaction to that because it's such a grotesque visual. And it's something that, again, I don't believe in rationally, but at night driving home, sometimes I do.
Nadia, are you the same?
Absolutely. I quite like sort of telling people stories about these different things, but also, like, there's a similar one from Sri Lanka called the Mohini, who is this woman in white who carrying a baby, and she will approach men or a man will see her. If you take the child from her, she'll say she's tired, and she'll hand the child to you. If you take it, she will eat you.
So don't be a good Samaritan.
Yeah, no. Just leave ladies in white with babies alone in Sri Lanka.
There's one that I love which frightens the daylights out of me, but I put that one in the book, so I don't want to spoil it for anyone.
I just want to do a time check here because it looks like our timer has gone a bit haywire.
Okay.
So I'm not actually sure where we're at. Is it time to open it up to questions now?
Yep.
Fantastic. Has anyone got any questions for Sammy or Nadia? There's microphones going around the room.
It's for Sammy. No pressure, but how long do we have to wait for the sequel?
I sent it to the publisher yesterday, so that's great. During office work hours too, which is not right of me. Anyway, it's done. It's been sent, and one of the things I'm working out with the publisher right now is because it was such a shot in the dark, this book, which no major publisher wanted it, no editor wanted it, because they all said, we love it, it's really frightening, it's well written, but we don't think there's a market for South Asian horror stories. And I believed otherwise, and I found a publisher, luckily, who also believes that. We've decided to kind of reward people who bought the first book by giving them the sequel as a free ebook when it does come out, hopefully by December.
Hi. I was wondering if the panel had seen the new Iranian Dijin movie called Under the Shadow that came out at MIFF, and if you had any comments on that.
No, I desperately wanted to, and I couldn't get around to watching it. It's I've heard good things about it, though. So there is that, but I absolutely desperately want to. I haven't seen any good visual representations of jinns yet on television or film or anything like that. And I really love to.
Although there is a book that I recently finished reading. It's a Turkish author called Elif Shafak. She writes in English, and it's called The Bastard of Istanbul. And about three quarters of the book has a lot of jinns in it. So it's really interesting to read. And it's also historical as well. So, yeah, I'd recommend that.
Hi.
Oh. Hello.
Also, there's just on a side note, there's a really very silly film called Wishmaster, which
About a djinn in a loose kind of way. Anyway,
there is that. Look, in terms of books, there's a few. There's some good ones. There's Gollum and Ginny, which is a very good one. The Gollum and the Djinn, sorry, which is a very good one about set in New York, about a djinn and from Jewish mythology, the Gollum kind of meeting each other and their experiences. That's a very interesting book and really well written as well. I can recommend that highly. G. Willow Wilson's Alif the Unseen. That came out a few years ago, and it was a very big hit. But it's G. Willow Wilson is I think, an American woman who converted to Islam, and her understanding of jinns is still kind of very influenced by three wishes and those kind of things, and Aladdin, and so it's very wrapped up in the Arabian Nights mythology. I wasn't as thrilled with that one. Don't tell her if I'm ever at a festival or something with her. And I'm trying to think. There's one more that I read recently. Ah, it's escaping me now. Well, Salman Rushdie, with his new one, that's right, he's got the jinns in it. I feel like Rushdie, and this is going to be very pompous of me to say at my low level of anything, but I feel like it's very hackneyed what he's doing now, where the jinns and everything are almost as jinns as seen through Western eyes versus true to what they originally were. And he does this trick which he names them something and the name is actually a word in Urdu, you know, from India and Pakistan, and he just and it's supposed to be clever because he does that, and I'm just tired of that trick now. So I can't read Rushdie anymore.
I was just going to say, in terms of these legends, and sometimes it's cautionary tales, but often they're quite fun. So with things like legends, myths, monsters, and then now like horror movies and horror books, why do we enjoy being scared?
Maybe that it gives us a sensation of being alive. That could be my response to that, Sammy.
From a chemical point of view, as far as I know and understand it, it's this exact same release of endorphins and everything as laughter. And it's interesting because my other job is as a stand-up comedian, which I like making people laugh and I like frightening people. The two things I like doing. I'm not a well-balanced person. But they both rely on the same trick, which is surprise. You are frightened when you're surprised. When someone says boo and you jump out of your skin, that's a frightened response that comes from surprise. And you have the same thing when you laugh, because laughter is a very involuntary reaction brought on by a surprising punchline to a joke. And I think there is that same kind of rush of delight that happens in your brain, and same things get triggered perhaps. Beyond that, why we enjoy it is there is a sense of masochism, probably. There's the same reason why we go in to watch the next horror movie and why we keep creating new horror myths like the Slender Man, is because coming up with that story and frightening someone else is just fun. And being frightened for a little while, it's a reminder that, I don't know, it's cliche that it may sound, it's a reminder that you're alive, because you can still feel that. It's a very emotional reaction. And it's a very fun emotional reaction when it's linked to something like the supernatural, and not when it's linked to something like unemployment, housing crisis, or, you know, one of those things.
I was reading a book recently, and it was talking about, it was talking about how before westernizing and like religion, how that babies could see demons and how they'd get possessed by them and they'd lash out and stuff. So I feel that that's kind of on the same lines as a djinn.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's and like you said, right, that is part of the djinn culture in South Asian countries.
Yeah, the babies can see other things. Like, they haven't quite sort of gotten the hang of reality yet, and so they have this sort of access that we grow out of eventually, so they can see the djinns and the buddies and everything else that's out there.
My friend's daughter, she was 2 years old, I remember, and she used to, every night, she used to start laughing and giggling, and they're like, "Who, you know, what are you laughing and giggling at?" And she's like, "That the old man." And they'd always ask, "Which old man?" And she's like, "That old man." And she'd point to just a corner of the room. And the parents and the family was very frightened. Like, they were actually... And the thing is, again, like, during the light of day, that stuff makes no sense. And the parents and everyone are like, whatever, just the child's imagination. But at 1 o'clock in the morning, when you hear a 2-year-old girl laughing and giggling and saying there's an old man right there, and she points to the dark corner, you don't take a chance.
And the thinking, right, is that the older you get, that you there's a curtain drawn over your eyes. That's why we don't see the djinn.
That's right. Until you become very old and that curtain gets lifted again.
Okay. So you come full circle.
Basically.
Yeah. Sorry, Nadia.
It's when you can't run away.
Yeah, yeah, when you can't run away, exactly.
So my question is, of all the stories that you know, is there one that really kind of, as an adult, you look at it and say, that's really just to make sure my kids behave? You know, and so, you know, with I think your example was don't pick sweets up off the floor because you'll pick up a djinn at the same time. Is there anything else like that that really kind of says to you, I'm just, you know, I just want my child to not be a maniac?
All of them.
Yeah, the Turkish all about one, the Turkish ones are interesting. Can you just tell some of them because they're very.
Yeah, there are some interesting Turkish ones. Things like don't run the hot water for too long. Clearly, your parents don't want you to run the hot water. Don't stare in the mirror for too long because they don't want you to be vain. They believe that you know you're opening up a portal for the djinns to enter. What other examples did I give?
We were told always come home come indoors during the Maghrib prayers because that's when jinns start possessing people now. The Maghrib prayers are at sunset, so basically parents just want their kids home at sunset. And don't be out at night is the idea. Yeah.
And there was also don't throw rubbish on the street. Mm-hmm. That's clearly not to litter the place. You know, they're kind
Jinns are very environmentally sound.
Yeah.
And they're very green. Yeah.
What about you, Nadia? Were you told any various versions?
Similar things. I still can't look in mirrors at night. It's one of those things where it's like, you know, just...
I can't cut my nails at night.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my dad used to tell me that all the time. Yeah. Don't cut your nails at night.
Yeah, don't cut... I don't know why. I have no idea why, but don't cut your nails at night. My daughter, like, when she has long nails, I have to cut them. I'm like, I've got to wait till morning.
I've got a theory because if you cut them and you don't do it neatly, you can't really see at night because they're little.
Right, of course.
So it's a cleanliness thing.
No, there's rational reasons for it. Yeah. Absolutely. But I'm still not doing it. Crazy.
I'm Puven from Malaysia. And when I was a child, I used to live in a Malay village. And my mom was actually possessed by a djinn when I was 10 years old. And I could relate to all those things that you're talking about today. Because how did we know that mom was possessed? Because my mom can't speak. She speaks Tamil. She's a Tamil speaker. But at the time she was possessed, she started speaking 4 or 5 languages, including Thai and, you know, Arabic and all of that. And that is how we started getting, you know, shamans in to start working with her. And we also realized that she was possessed because at the time she was praying, because, you know, I come from a Hindu family. And at the time when she was praying and we were staying very close to the mosque, so when the Maghrib prayers come on, she was getting really agitated and, you know, she grows really wild.
So how did they remove the djinn from her?
So what we did, because she was talking in multiple languages, we didn't really know what actually possessed her. As you said, you know, interestingly, you said that could the djinn be Christian or could the djinn be Chinese or could the djinn be Malay or Muslim? And what we did was the Muslim shamans couldn't get rid of this djinn. And so we had to get a Chinese person to come in. And then an Indian guy finally got the djinn out of her by whipping her. And luckily she didn't die because, you know, the djinn managed to just leave her. Because,
and how old were you when this was happening?
I was 10 years old. Because when my mom was possessed, she actually lit the mattress that we were sleeping on. And, you know, when the fumes started coming up, then we know something is not quite right with mom. Yeah, so this is like a lived experience, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, and also when you were talking about Pontianak and Mohini, I could also relate to that because my uncle was actually in love with someone, a Mohini, for a few weeks.
Oh, wow.
And it started going, following him back to his house, literally knocking on the door.
So, like the banshee from Scottish mythology.
I mean, this is like, you know, I mean, I've been living with this kind of stories around me.
Well, that's just it. I like the idea that those stories are lived experience for so many parts of the population. It's just that these stories don't make it into popular culture or into books and things. And I feel like we're at the point now where we've run out of scary stories from the vampires and werewolves and everything, and maybe it's time to find out about what's scaring the rest of the world, because that tells us so much about their cultures and societies as well.
That's right. And, I mean, you wouldn't just come out and tell someone that story in a public forum, but you had the opportunity to tell that story. Anyone else got a story like that?
I was wondering if there should be a concern, or is there a concern when representing this mythology in fiction, especially when it has religious origins, of being offensive to people, or particularly if that mythology is interpreted through a Western lens. Say, if I was to write, you know, an Australian woman to write about djinns, if I found this fascinating and I did my research, you know, where's the line? It's fiction, you know.
If you've done your research, and you know, then I don't think that there is necessarily a line. It's just that, you know, most people want their stories told. They just don't want to be used.
Mm. I think it's just they just want to be done respectfully. Yeah. Neil Gaiman had djinns in American Gods, and nobody complained because it was done respectfully, almost like it was a good representation of them. And the same happens with the Lucifer comic series by Michael Carey. And there are many different representations of different cultures and mythologies that people can do well. It's when you do it with a lack of consideration and respect that then things like culture and misappropriation get thrown around. What was the first part of the question? Sorry, I remember being interested in that, and now I'm blanking. Oh, the religious part. Well, it's the book, for example, right now. So it came out an Australian publisher, but I just sold the rights to a publisher in India. So they handle India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and United Kingdom. And for the India, Pakistan, Bangladesh portion of the contract, there is a blasphemy clause, which is that no part of the book commits an act of blasphemy. Now, the first half of the book doesn't. The first book doesn't. But the second book skirts it a bit, because it's got elements from Islamic mythology which we haven't gotten into yet, like Dajjal and those creatures, which might upset some people. So the publisher is right now going to a lawyer and finding out whether it's safe or you know, to do those things. I think if I was still a practicing, believing Muslim, I might not even have written the book, because you need some distance to kind of write about these things. But at the same time, I wouldn't want anyone to read this and feel like it's disrespectful of their beliefs, because it comes from a place of love and adoration for those myths. And I think that's what the intention is important.
And as we mentioned earlier, I mean, there has been Aladdin and I Dream of Jeannie, so it's onwards and upwards from there.
Yeah. We've already hit the...
we've hit bottom, so...
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.